Welcome back to A Hunger for Wholeness, a podcast from the Center for Christogenesis. My name is Jillian Langford, and I am the producer of this podcast. You are about to join us for part two of a two-part interview with Dr. Stephen Dick, who is a notable NASA scientist and astrobiologist. Last episode, Ilya Delio, Robert Nicastro, and Dr. Stephen Dick sat down and talked about the polarity of worlds, cosmotheology, and astrobiology, and a little bit about the history of extraterrestrial life. And in this second episode, the conversation continues with our three hosts and guests talking about what is God in the world of quantum physics and the idea of process theology, an idea that is very near and dear to us in the work of Ilya Delio and at the Center for Christogenesis. So if you haven't listened to part one, I don't know why you haven't yet, because we talk about extraterrestrial life and the polarity of worlds. So get back there, listen to part one, then come here and join us for part two of this interview with astrobiologist Dr. Stephen Dick.
I've never heard the term cosmotheology, but it seems to me that theology is cosmic by nature.
Right.
Although you're right, it's gotten stuck between this nature and supernature divide. But I even think the word nature is no longer really helpful, because we know so much more about the stuff of life than we've ever known before. I think nature has served too often as an umbrella for, you know, what we call trees and water and sun. And, you know, it's the way we've carved up the world, so to speak, between a God who, you know, creates and watches over and this beautiful stuff called nature, when the whole thing is really quite entangled, if I can use that language, you know. It's inseparable realities. They're sort of a whole, you know. And so maybe does cosmotheology, you know, speak of a whole, you know, an entangled whole or a deep interconnected wholeness?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, people have argued in terms of God, and this is possible that, you know, through the normal means of cosmic evolution, as intelligence developed, you get superintelligences. You know, maybe there is a superintelligence out there that is not supernatural, but is a normal product of cosmic evolution. And people like Fred Hoyle, the astronomer Fred Hoyle, who's kind of a maverick astronomer and has, you know, 100 wild ideas, and maybe one of them might be good. But one of his ideas was that there is this superintelligence out there. And he thought that was possible because you have to explain some things like what's called the anthropic principle, this idea that the universe is fine-tuned for life, that we wouldn't be here if the gravitational constant were slightly different, because the planets would never have formed, and the same with all the other constants. So who did all that tinkering so that that we can actually exist? Now, let me say that the anthropic principle is really a misnomer, because it's not about the universe being fit for humans. It's about the universe being fit for life. So it's really better to say the biocentric.
Mm.
So then the question becomes, how did that happen? And that's why you get these ideas that some people have put forward about the multiverse. Maybe we just happen to be in a universe where that is true, where the constants are fine-tuned and we are here, but there are other universes that exist that, you know, do not have life. Unfortunately, there's no way to prove that any more than you can prove God. So it still remains a conundrum. But I do think when you talk about a superintelligence and some of the attributes that are normally given to God, like omnipotence and that sort of thing, that it could be a natural superintelligence that exists. I wouldn't argue that that kind of superintelligence actually intervenes in history, which of course is a big part of Christianity and other religions. But nevertheless, it would have some of the characteristics that you normally would ascribe to God.
Yes, right. So, you know, the difference between classical theology that has omnipotence and omniscience and immutability, and process theology that has God, you know, not knowing necessarily what the future is going to be, or a power that might be a persuasive power, but not necessarily a controlling power. So I think what your work and I think what science does for us today, it asks us to revisit this tremendous word, God. I think when we use this language of God, we import automatically, because we're so wired to think this way.
That's right.
We import the medieval God, you know, whether or not we do that, you know, consciously or unconsciously. But when we use that language of God, the first thing we think of are all the attributes that were given to God by the medievalists.
That's
and
right.
Those, you know, afterwards. But I think what science does is maybe it says, well, wait a minute. You know, I think this is what Whitehead did. You know, he stopped and said, wait a minute. What is God? You know, what is God in this world of quantum physics, of consciousness, mind and matter, of biological complexity and systems? And now we can explore other galaxies. We can anticipate other forms of intelligent life. What is this? You know, who is God? I think that's the question that we need to engage more fully today, rather than coming into these big cosmological questions with presumptions about God. Like, oh, we know what God is. Now we just have to fit God into this scenario. Yeah. And I'm like, no, I don't think so. You know, I think we're being invited into something very new.
I agree, absolutely. And the denial of supernaturalism, you know, has some pretty big implications, not only about the existence of a divine being, but about the, for example, divinely inspired writings like the Bible. If there's no supernatural divine God, then the Bible, you know, can't be divinely inspired. And the Bible, of course, is the best-selling book of all times. And, you know, I like the Bible from a point of view of literature and from the point of view of a very checkered history. But from the point of view of divine revelation, I would have to deny that.
Well, I mean, it's reasonable, right? In other words, if we're still evolving, if our intelligence is still growing, how can we say this is the final revelation? I mean, I'm sure some philosopher out there of much more Catholic persuasion will find some logical solution to that. But, you know, just common sense, it just doesn't make all that much sense. So, and of course, I think God would be like, what's their problem? Why are they shutting the door on me anyway? You know, I mean, I'm just full of life. So why don't you just keep, you know, and I'm happy. God is like, I'm happy to keep showing myself in just a zillion different ways. So why keep shutting this book, you know, and thinking that you think you know what I am? So I like to say God is much more playful, adventurous. I think God thinks these humans are just really dead in the water sometimes, you know, because their heads are in the sand. So I'm much more the scientist type, I guess.
For me, the great revelation was, you know, just, you don't have to go back thousands of years. You can just go back to the last century or century and a half, because even around the turn of the last century, around 1903, I think A.R. Wallace, some people recognize the name, was the co-founder with Darwin of the theory of natural selection. And he wrote a book on astronomy called Man's Place in the Universe, based on, you know, the best knowledge of the day, what astronomers knew. And he concluded that the galaxy was 3,600 light years in diameter and that the Earth was pretty much right in the center. And that's based on what astronomers knew, you know, 150 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then came along Hubble in the 1920s, and then the Hubble Space Telescope, and now the James Webb Space Telescope. And we know that our own galaxy is 100,000 light years across, and it's one of billions and billions of galaxies, as Carl Sagan used to say. And so you get these images, the one we saw recently from the James Webb Telescope, which is like, it's looking at a part of the sky that's just like looking through a straw, and you see thousands of galaxies. Virtually every point of light in that image is a galaxy. And of course, those galaxies have stars and they probably have planets. Whether they have life, we don't know. But I think that's the framework, that's the context that you have to put our sort of religious aspirations into.
So basically, the Earth is like in a crowded mall at Christmas. Tons of people, tons of planets, tons of intelligence, tons of activity in this whole cosmic whole. And of course, millions and millions of planets, right? If I understand correctly.
That's right. Yeah. Well, we know we've identified 5,000 or 6,000 now. And the only reason that number is so low is because we've only looked at a tiny part of the galaxy. So it turns out that virtually every star has planets. So it would be, our Milky Way galaxy has, say, 200 billion stars. So that probably means more than a trillion planets. And as I say, not all of them are habitable, but some of them are. And so when you're talking about numbers like that, I think it's likely that there's not only microbial life out there, but also intelligent life. So I think it's one of the great remaining questions of science.
Fantastic, really. Rob, I'm going to let you talk, but there's just so many questions for me. And one is, of course, as Catholics, salvation. Two questions, Steve, are other forms of intelligent life saved? And what do you hope for at death? I mean, do you hope to go to heaven? Where's heaven for you? What's eternal life for you?
What are you talking about, for me?
Yeah.
Oh.
You can give me your theoretical answer, or you can give me your personalized form of your theoretical answer.
Well, my mantra is, stardust thou art, and to stardust thou shalt return.
Okay. So,
to take off on what, Genesis, I guess?
From dust you have come, and till dust you. That's our penitential service at Lent.
That's literally true. We came from the stars. The elements that are in our bodies were cooked up in the stars. So we are star stuff, as Carl Sagan used to like to say. And into stardust we shall return sooner or later. And that's enough for me to return to the stars. It's all part of the cycle, the process of what's going on in the universe. I don't need a heaven, a hell, or a purgatory.
Cool. Any form of eternal resurrective life, resurrection then is just becoming, joining with the stars again. In other words, joining with the cosmos. And it's
that. Right. Yeah, that could be a form of resurrection, going back to returning to the origins. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Steve, what about personality or particularity? Would that remain for you, or does that get absorbed?
I would think it would not remain. We would be sort of scattered to the winds out there. So I don't think, I don't see, I'm willing to listen to an argument if you had one, but I don't see that would be true right offhand.
I've always thought we're resurrected through our relationships. In other words, the good that we've done, the love that we've, shared here.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
We live on sort of, you might say, in the memory of others, because our life, in a sense, is passed on through those relationships.
And through books such as the ones you have written.
And writing a lot of books. More relationships, though. I do think the books will go to dust, too, eventually.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that true even on the lowest level of life, that memory is required for new connections to form and to get sustained in genetic life? And
sure, that's true. You could get into the whole question of consciousness and intelligence. And, some people would claim that their dogs and cats are very intelligent. Some people would go way below that. If you asked 20 different experts, when did intelligence arise on Earth, you'd get 20 different answers, because it's not like one day there was no intelligence and the next day there was. It's, again, a part of evolution. And that's the sort of question that we also have to consider when we're looking for intelligence out there. I think it's very likely, as I said, that it's not going to be anything like us, and probably not in the same stage of evolution that we are, because if you've got a universe, billions of years old, what are the chances that they're, when we think about searching for extraterrestrial intelligence, we think about looking for people like ourselves who have radio telescopes and that sort of thing. But the chances that they're at the same stage of evolution, civilization, and society that we are is extremely remote. So what are you really looking for? We don't know until we stumble on it or find it one way or another.
Yeah, no, that's really true. In the last few seconds, I just want to bring up, the one person that I've been studying is Teilhard de Chardin.
Oh, yes.
Albert too has been devoting his work to Teilhard. And of course, in the last chapter of his essays on Christianity and evolution, he devotes a whole thing to the next level of conscious life, which would be the exploration and discovery of what he called an intergalactic life or intergalactic consciousness. Mm-hmm. Now, what's so interesting about Teilhard, and what I think is really interesting, is in terms of theology, we think God is, again, our classic story of God creating us here and, the fall into sin and all that kind of stuff. And Teilhard said, no, actually, the whole the whole of evolution is God seeking to complete God's self in created conscious life. And so he saw that, you know, this God Omega, that there is this push in evolution for greater intelligence, greater conscious life, precisely because God is seeking completion in us. In other words, Teilhard would say God is incomplete and seeking completion. Same thing that Carl Jung said, and some of the, it's a process idea, mm-hmm. which would make our search for intelligent life not just a human hobby, it's a theological vocation. In other words, we're doing this because there's something driving us to do it, and we don't even know what that drive is sometimes. But I think if we go deep enough, that drive is God. It's God seeking to become God in the universe. And that's a pretty exciting way of looking at cosmotheology, not a supernatural God, not some kind of extraordinary things here. It's actually nature that is itself potent for divinity.
Yeah, well, Teilhard is obviously one of those people who has thought deeply about God. He just didn't accept, you know, the standard ideas. And I think Teilhard fits quite nicely, as you pointed out in your talk at the Claremont School of Theology back in May, quite nicely into process theology, which is all about becoming and evolving. So Teilhard, I think, points out that you have these synergies between science and religion. Religion, you know, with all of its flaws, is not going to go away. It's obviously a human aspiration, but I do think, as I think you do, that it needs to evolve beyond its origins in a geocentric universe. And that's where I think there can be a synergy between the scientists and the theologians and religious people. We really can enter into a productive dialogue.
Yeah, and I think it's actually extremely important, because I think why the general public does not really support, you know, enthusiastically space exploration, because it seems superfluous. In other words, we're here in this quote unquote sinful world, and we need to, you know, pray and work our way out of this world back to God. But what if the whole, if they understood that the space exploration is God seeking to become God? You know, in other words, the healing of science and religion is not just an intellectual pursuit, it's the healing of the human community. It's sort of like the record is a little bit warped, or, you know, the needle's a little bit broke, and we're trying to reset the whole thing where it can really function in a more coherent way in a universe now that we're discovering to be not just large, but full of life. And I think if Earth is going to really survive, you know, there's no guarantee that Earth is going to survive mm-hmm. in this long future of cosmic life. We need to get our theological scientific story together a little bit more coherently. And I think the religions have been entirely too reticent, too protective of their turf. But I don't think we can afford to do so anymore. I don't think this conversation on science and religion is just an intellectual thing. I think it affects the very person going to Acme and Wegmans and going to the post office, and it affects everything about us. And our job is to help bring this into greater reality. Why we need science and religion to be almost on the same page, or at least in the same book.
Right, right. I agree absolutely. When I was at NASA, one of the main questions I was asked when I went out to the public was, you know, why should we do this space exploration when we have all these problems? Just as you mentioned, all these problems on Earth. And I always said that, well, we can do both, and that. And I couldn't talk, as a government employee at NASA, I couldn't talk much about religion, because there is separation of church and state.
Right.
I couldn't use a religious argument, but I certainly sympathize with the kind of argument that you just gave, that our sort of spiritual and religious aspirations are very much connected to the universe of which we are part, and we're seeking the wholeness of being, then you better be talking about the whole universe and our place in it.
Exactly, exactly. Robert, do you have any final questions you'd like to ask?
And Steve, you're already answering this in some ways, but I'll ask it explicitly. We know, based upon your work, that the idea, the discipline of cosmotheology is a relatively recent invention. Where do you hope to see, or how do you hope to see it develop in the future? What are your hopes for it?
Well, I would have to say I've been writing about cosmotheology for maybe two decades now. And when I explained to my my brother-in-law what cosmotheology was, and I said, it hasn't really taken the world by storm, his reply was, I hope not, because he's a devout Christian, you know, and this is a kind of a shock to Christians and people who believe in the standard religions. But I would just hope that, you know, if people read my work, that it would open their minds to the possibilities. And it's not something that's going to happen overnight, but something that could evolve as part of cultural evolution in the future, probably on a longer rather than a shorter timeline.
Yeah. Steve, what one book would you recommend to our listeners? People interested in your work or interested in the question of astrobiology or astrotheology?
Right. Well, the astrotheology book of Ted Peters is an edited volume which has a lot of different authors in and different opinions. On my own work, well, there are two books. One is called The Impact of Discovering Life Beyond Earth, and that's an edited volume which has 22 authors. When I was at the Library of Congress, we did a symposium. This is the very well-written, I think, and very open to the public discussion of what the impact might be, written by philosophers and scientists and historians and all kinds of people. So that's published by Cambridge, and it's I think it's, you know, at a reasonable price, so people, that's accessible to people. My own take is in a book that was published in 2018 called Astrobiology, Discovery, and Societal Impact. That is also by Cambridge, and that book talks about astrotheology, some of the areas we haven't talked about, astroethics, but all the implications that might occur, especially in terms of worldviews and changing worldviews. We haven't talked about worldviews, but I consider the biological universe a kind of a worldview, you know, in the same way that the geocentric system was a worldview that very much affected culture, like Dante's Inferno and all of that. And the biological universe is very much affecting our culture too, in terms of science fiction and films. You know, some of the most popular films of all times have been about aliens. And so there's no doubt that this worldview of the biological universe is affecting us. The main question still is it true or not? So that's what astrobiology is all about.
So, and maybe on one final note, do you have a favorite science fiction film? You know, like I was thinking of like Contact, or, you know, there's some movies that have been dealing with, you know, the pursuit or discovery of extraterrestrial life.
Right. I do like Contact. I knew Sagan somewhat. I would run into him every once in a while at the American Astronomical Society meetings. And I won't go into the story about Sagan being sued by Francis Ford Coppola over the intellectual content in Contact, but I was involved in that case and so read the book and saw the movie many times. But that certainly would be one of them. Of course, the classic is Arthur C. Clarke. I'm a big fan of his 2001 A Space Odyssey, which, you know, leaves the big mystery at the end for everybody to contemplate. Not so much, I'm not so much a Star Wars fan, you know, because I don't like the idea of wars anyway. So, you know, it's the typical rebels against the Empire and that sort of thing, which is, you know, plays well in the public, but I think it's not so well thought out, or, you know, doesn't raise some of the major questions that are raised in other films like Contact in 2001.
Yeah. Did you ever read the novels by Maria Doria Russell?
Oh, sure. No, those are
Sparrow
the
and Children of God.
She has an anthropology background. So, those I would consider very good. Children of God and The Sparrow. Yeah.
I mean, Children of God, I thought was incredible. The way she, right, you know, the Jesuit mission, I won't give the story away because if you haven't read the books out there, you should read them. You know, they eventually land on this planet. But the way she can, you know, imagined spatially how they situated themselves, the shapes of bodies, it was incredible.
Yeah, and in general, I think science fiction, good science fiction, can be very valuable in this endeavor. And I talk about this in some detail in the Astrobiology, Discovery, and Societal Impact book. Good science fiction writers have laid out a lot of different scenarios, including post-biological scenarios. And reading some of those science fiction novels will really open your mind. When I get stuck on my writing or something, I always like to read science fiction because it immediately opens your mind to new possibilities. So I would encourage listeners to read some of those alien science fiction novels. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that because, you know, our minds have the capacity for so much more. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the old adage, we're only using 10% of our gray matter and most of it is just withering away. And the fact is we have this incredible capacity to dream and imagine what doesn't yet exist. And that, to me, is a remarkable feat of the human person. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of the problems with our society. We don't dream enough. We don't imagine enough. We live in this kind of existentialist survival mode. So I love this, what you're doing and your interest. And I hope that, you know, we can convey to the wider public, first of all, the importance of your work, which I think is extremely important, especially for today, for the whole dialogue of science and religion. And most of all, to get us to imagine that we are not alone in this universe, that we're not stranded on this poor little planet of Earth, just making our way to a place called heaven, that we're going to hang out there forever with God and do what? I have no idea. Read books.
I very much recommend your volumes also.
Oh, thanks, Steve. That's very kind of you. Yeah, well, I just finished a book called The Not Yet God.
Okay.
It's on Carl Jung, Teilhard de Chardin, and the relational whole.
Okay.
Holism. Yeah. So a lot of what you're thinking about, I'm thinking it through my own way, but the questions of nature and supernature, you know, I think these are definitely need to be recast with what within the context of what we know today. I also think science is impelling us to change our basic understanding of God. You know, I find about 99% of the discussions keep importing the classical medievalist God, you know, the Thomistic God, and they want to know how this God's going to fit into this world.
Right.
It doesn't work that way. God's never worked that way, actually.
Right.
So we're in a very exciting time. And I think we're at a time I see where our hour is up. But first of all, I just want to thank you for being here and for what you're doing.
It's been a great discussion. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah. And thank you, Robert. I don't know if you have any parting words here. I can give them to you.
No, your word is always the best to go to be last. So. But thank you, Steve. This was a really enriching conversation. I really appreciate your time and your willingness to do this for us.
Okay, my pleasure.
Yeah, and hope to see you at a new colloquium.
Yes, right.
Thank you for listening to part two of this two-part episode with astrobiologist Dr. Stephen Dick and your hosts, Ilya Delio and Robert Nicastro. My name is Jillian Langford, and I am the producer of this podcast. This podcast is made in friendly partnership with our friends at the Fetzer Institute. Kate Christensen is our marketing and social media genius, and Gregory Hansel helped to conceive this podcast idea. Robert Nicastro helps with our scheduling, and we work in partnership with the Center for Christogenesis. We want to take a moment to thank you for the incredible success that this podcast has seen in our first season. We launched all the way back in August, and now in December, we have come to the end of our first season. You can expect new episodes from us with new speakers in the new year. And if you just can't get enough and want to follow along, make sure that you are smashing that follow button on Instagram. We're A Hunger for Wholeness. We're on Twitter with the same handle. And you can also become a donor on patreon.com and help to make season 2 and 3 and beyond of this podcast possible. And finally, if you want to get real up close and intimate with the work of the Center for Christogenesis, we are hosting our annual conference on February 3 through 5. It's all online. Dr. Stephen Dick will be there as a presenter. You can register today at christogenesis.org. Once again, we thank you so deeply for your support of this podcast, and we look forward to seeing you in season 2 in 2023. This has been Hunger for Wholeness.